I spoke to about a third of the members of the Althung one night, and I said, I don't know this, but I would wager that the Chinese ambassador to Iceland is urging you to let us keep our base here, and they all nodded. It wasn't such a shrewd guess because I did know that the Chinese ambassadors to Turkey, Greece, and Cyprus were urging them to get along in order to keep NATO strong. I've been saying for the last several years that the Chinese were the best NATO ally we have because they understand the importance of a strong NATO as a counterweight to the 50 Soviet divisions that are along the Chinese border. The Chinese have made it clear that they welcome the continuing presence of U.S. troops in Korea, Japan, Thailand while they were there, even Taiwan, the Philippines, because they are so desperately afraid of the Soviet military power. While we're putting 5% of our gross national product into military, and while the Soviets are outspending us in dollars by putting 15% of theirs, the Chinese are desperately struggling less dollars by putting 20% of their GNP into military. They're scrambling to get missiles to sea to avoid nuclear castration, and they're scrambling to get tactical air to build up with their superior manpower. Now, there have been some signals in recent months that are ominous, signals that indicate that the Chinese are considering whether or not they can continue this de facto alliance with us. The first of these was that they announced they were liquidating their support of the third faction in Angola when they saw the handwriting on the wall there with the Soviet demonstration of power. So the second was their sudden decision that the Soviet helicopter crew that they had held prisoner for 2 years hadn't been spying after all, and they released it. The third was their insulting of President Ford when he was in China and their expression of horror when he fired Schlesinger as the one man in the cabinet whom they felt understood what the Russians were up to and was trying to get the facts out. And the final signal was their invitation to Mr. Nixon to visit China, which was designed to infuriate Mr. Ford.
I'd like to ask you about consolidation of helicopter training at Fort Rucker, and also your views on women in service academies.
Okay, with regard to consolidation of helicopter training, I think that the thing that we have to worry about in the services is the increasing effort to create a single service. In those countries that have tried it, it's been a disaster, and in Canada, where they've lived with it for a few years, they're gradually beginning to separate the services again. Now, in order to avoid that tragedy, one has to make every possible effort to achieve efficiencies by consolidating the three services, getting together to consolidate where it's intelligent to do so and not to consolidate where it's not intelligent to do so because the missions differ. The three services, up until the time I retired, had begun to make progress, and I believe they are continuing to, at getting together through their three logistics commanders to work out these kinds of consolidations, and I suspect that helicopter training is one where it makes sense to do it. Now, the kind of a situation in which one would have to be cautious, I think, is where special training is required. You can never do naval aviation training under an Air Force because of the carrier problem. Right, just the basic training is the place to consolidate, I think.
And then the women
in it. With regard to women, I was, I guess, the one member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff who favored women going to the service academies, as a result of which Mr. Nixon sent over the word when the Congress was going to hold hearings in 1974 that I was not to testify, but rather to send my number two, who it was known opposed women going to the Naval Academy. They therefore had unanimous testimony against it, whereupon Congress promptly authorized it. I don't think that it's going to make the difference between Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and it eliminates a source of friction. The great argument used against it was that you can't send women into combat. But we have always had a large fraction of graduates of the service academies go into non-combat kinds of specialties, and the women will merely be a small subset of that fraction.
Do you consider yourself conservative or liberal?
I have trouble with what I am because I try to come out with what I think is the right answer on each issue, and sometimes that has me on the conservative side and sometimes it has me on the moderate side. I think that those labels are overworked. Although on a given issue, I suppose I could tell you where I am.
What about national health insurance? I heard you mention it. I'm in a health field. I'd like to know what you're thinking of.
I'm serving on the board of the American Health Foundation, which is a board that specializes in preventive medicine. And one of the things I'm convinced of after going through the cost statistics for about a year and a half is that we can save the country money in the medical field if we have an intelligent preventive medicine program, and that if we phase that in properly, we can reduce overall costs to the country. Now, what do I mean by that? We know today that if we have the opportunity to give a positive physical examination every year to everybody, we can pick up a lot of incipient disease. Early hardening of the arteries, early proneness toward heart attack, that kind of thing. I believe it's possible to phase in sensible medical programs using private insurance systems, not socialized medicine, in a way that will, at the very least, provide care for catastrophic illness, which today is destroying families when they run into a long string of bad luck, and which over time can probably go further as we begin to generate savings through a preventive medicine system. I don't think we can afford to authorize an across-the-board national medical care. I think you've got to do it in an intelligent and business-like way to take advantage of the savings that I believe we'll demonstrate.
Do you feel that the current manpower through the schools, the medical schools, the dental schools, pharmacy schools, as such, do you think that we can provide for health care for our nation in the future without increasing our enrollment now?
The issue, I think, comes down to whether or not the free enterprise system is being permitted to operate in accordance with supply and demand, or whether the constraints put upon the institutions that train the health sciences are such that supply cannot respond to demand. I believe that that's the place to examine and to look for intelligent and efficient ways to make it easier for supply to respond to demand if that is a problem. The studies that I last examined, which I suppose were now 2.5 years out of date, indicated to me that the system still did have the capability to respond and was beginning to respond with some help, such as the Armed Services Medical Academy, which has now been authorized, and such as the subsidized internships that the services have been authorized to have, which over time will add to civilian sources.
Then how do you feel about Senator Kennedy's bill requiring a certain percentage of the interim medical classes to be only allowed to practice in the areas where the government says they can go?
Well, I always worry about a system that begins to prescribe where people must go and how they must live and that sort of thing. I'd want to use that as a last resort if it turned out that we were simply unable to provide adequate medical care in significant geographical regions of the country. And I'd like to see us examine economic incentives long before we went into a mandatory assignment system.
What's your position on the right to work law?
I've publicly stated time and time again that I favor the continuation of the present law.
Admiral, I know you've been expecting this question. We have heard and read a lot in the news media.